Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Well, you knew it wouldn't be easy what Amazon is saying about the union victory in New York. One claim, getting workers high so they vote union. And today on the show, the latest from The Nation and the North Coast Labor Federation. Welcome to the Thursday, June 16th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today, this being the third Thursday. We generally check in with one of the prolific writers at The Nation magazine, and we have a good one today. Bryce Covert will be joining us. Bryce is an independent journalist. She writes about the economy. She also, along with The Nation, contributes to the New York Times, Time Magazine, Washington Post, New York Magazine, The New Republic, even Forbes Magazine. I mean, she's all over the place. She's won a number of awards. And the article, actually two articles we're going to talk about today. One involves the nursing profession, and it's titled, Nurses Are Fighting Back, But the Nightmare Continues. And if you go back a couple of years when the pandemic started, we had the shutdown in March of 2020. Nurses, of course, well, they're always on the front line, but many of them died or got horribly sick, terrible working conditions. And you heard about this nurse shortage? Well, Bryce says that's a false narrative. As one nurse told her, nurses are finally realizing that they're important and they have rights. And they're a force. It's about time, said one. And it should have been like that a long time ago. Poor conditions at hospitals. Lack of staff. Now, many of them said, well, we've got to organize. We got to get a union. They did that. But still, little has changed. And we're going to talk about that. Nurses are fighting back, but the nightmare continues. Now, the other story is about arbitration. And this is kind of interesting because arbitration has picked up steam over the years. And our Congress has pretty much admitted that forced arbitration is a corrupt practice, but they only banned it in one area. And she's going to talk about that. Why forced arbitration is unjust? Well, let me tell you. More than 60 million workers are barred from taking their complaints to court. 56%. Non-union private sector workers are subjected to forced arbitration. And here's what happens. The arbitrator is usually picked by the company. So it's already stacked against you. And if you had the opportunity to take your case, and this could be somebody that got fired on the job, anything. It could be a product that you're complaining about. And you always got to read the fine print when you buy something. Make sure you do that. Not too many people do that. But if you go to a state court, you're going to do pretty well. And there's some numbers that we're going to talk about later in the show. When you win a court battle versus arbitration, I mean, it's sometimes 10 times the difference. I saw one figure in state courts, 328,000, arbitration, 23,000. Big difference there. So Bryce Covert will be our first guest on the show. Pat Gallagher will be joining us from Philadelphia. He's still in Philadelphia. The AFL-CIO Constitutional Convention wrapped up yesterday. And he's been to a number of these. And in fact, Pat told me the other day, I said, out of the five or six that he's gone to, this one was pretty much at the top of the list. President Biden took the stage on, what was it, Tuesday or yesterday? I don't know which day he was there. But you know what? That entire speech from Biden, if you just Google Biden AFL-CIO, you might want to check that out on YouTube. And he delivered remarks about the middle class and how important unions are to rebuilding the middle class. We'll touch on a couple of other speakers, including Liz Shuler, Fred Redmond, who were elected as president and secretary treasurer, respectively, Marty Walsh, and then Stacey Abrams. Stacey Abrams fired up the crowd. In fact, I have a clip here, which we're going to play right here on America's Workforce. Let's listen to Stacey Abrams, and she is currently a governor for the state of Georgia.
We've got to build a movement to meet the moment. In this room is the chance to change the world. And it happens in November 2022. In 21 weeks, we can tell America who we are and who we intend to be. In 21 weeks, we can shift the narrative from headwinds and losses that are expected to miracles and to showing people who we can really be. Most of the changes we face in this country didn't happen in Washington, D.C. They happened at the state level. You see, stand your ground didn't happen in Washington. It happened under Governor Jeb Bush in Florida. Mass incarceration didn't start in 94 in Washington, D.C. It started in 1970s under Governor Ronald Reagan. We know that the erosion of the social safety net didn't happen in 1996 in D.C. It happened in 1990 under Governor Tommy Thompson. And Jim Crow never had a single federal law. It was all governors in the South who said who we were going to be. And it's going to be governors in the South who say who we're going to be next. That is the opportunity we have in this nation. And that is the opportunity of this election.
Stacey Abrams at the AFL-CIO convention this week in Philadelphia. You can tell she is fired up, along with all the people that attended that convention, including Mr. Pat Gallagher, who will be joining us later in the show. In labor news, we got an interesting story unraveling regarding the union and Amazon in New York, the Amazon Labor Union, ALU. Their post-election administrative hearing before a National Labor Relations Board officer began on Monday of this week and is set to continue through tomorrow, at least, to consider the various objections that Amazon filed in the wake of their stunning victory in April. That's where they organized at the Staten Island warehouse, and the vote was 55% in favor of the union. Well, in a last-ditch effort to overturn the election results, sound familiar? Amazon filed more than two dozen objections a week after the union's victory, accusing both the union and the NLRB, Region 29, the region that managed the election, of improper conduct during the election. More specifically, Amazon's lawyers accused the union leaders and organizers of intimidating employees, perpetuating lies about the company, engaging in electioneering in the polling place, get this, distributing marijuana among the workforce in exchange for support, and accused Region 29 agents of generally, quote, acting throughout this proceeding in a manner that unfairly or inappropriately facilitated the union's victory. Conduct which, according to the attorneys from the law firm, a union-busting law firm, Hunter, Andrews, and Kurth, representing Amazon, destroyed the laboratory conditions necessary for a free and fair election. Well, on the first day of the hearing officer deferred the ruling from the union's motion to dismiss many of Amazon's objections, requiring the company to first provide an offer of proof, thereby setting the stage for a lengthy and contentious proceeding that will likely continue throughout the rest of the month. So we got a couple weeks to go on that. Well, you knew it wasn't going to be easy. Come on, let's face it here. And one more here before we break. Theatrical stage employees, this would be IATSE Local B29, have proudly announced that workers at the Miller Theater won their organizing campaign. Organizing started back in 2005 and resumed in 2009 after years of campaigning. Even a global pandemic couldn't stop the workers from coming together to form a union. The Miller Theater is part of the Kimmel Cultural Campus in the city of Philadelphia. Got a comment here from Rich Montgomery, who's president of Local B29. He said, "We are proud of the growth of our local with the 30 new front-of-house workers that have the same rights and benefits as the other members of Local B29. And we'd like to thank IATSE President Matthew Loeb and his staff for their leadership and guidance in this long and hard fought union drive." Can you believe that? Organizing started in 2005. What year is it? 2022? All right, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, our segment with The Nation magazine and writer Bryce Covert. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans. And we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers. And we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit SurveyandBallotSystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Make sure you get the word union in there. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency. They connect people with employment, good employment, I might add, with great wages and good benefits. You can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go to New York City right now. And joining us on line number one is Bryce Covert. Bryce is an independent journalist, and she's been the contributing writer for The Nation. This is our segment we do each and every month with The Nation magazine, usually on the third Thursday of the month. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Washington Post, New York Magazine, Wired, New Republic, Slate, among others. Last time that she was on the show was some years ago, and we were talking about the culture, or lack thereof, at McDonald's. Bryce Covert, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be repping the Nation.
And the story we want to talk about, well, one of them, deals with nursing and what nurses have been going through with the pandemic. Before we get into that, like I said, the last time we talked about McDonald's and cases of sexual harassment, I know their CEO had a step down. This was a couple years back.
Yep.
Anything new in that regard, Bryce? Maybe some developments you can talk about?
Yes. So after there was a lot of spotlight on the culture of harassment at McDonald's, both, as you mentioned, in the restaurants themselves, but also in the corporate headquarters, a lot of scandal around their former CEO, the company promised that it would take action and implement a new set of standards about harassment and other things, workplace violence, that would be enforced not just at corporate stores, but at franchise ones too, which at the time, I thought it was actually a really interesting and possibly impressive promise. The company gave itself the deadline of doing so by the end of January this year. Turns out that when I spoke to workers in their stores, nothing had changed and nothing had happened, and they blew past their own deadline. And when I asked for comment, they basically just said they weren't going to be doing anything.
just ignore it and just keep on doing what we're doing. That's sad, isn't it? And that has happened in so many parts of the country today. It's very sad, and you have to wonder where the accountability is. But that's another story. I'm sure you'll be on that one. The one we want to primarily focus on today is about our nurses. And the title of this piece is Nurses Are Fighting Back, But the Nightmare Continues. Despite a wave of strikes spurred by the pandemic, they are still working in unsustainable conditions in hospitals that are dangerously understaffed. And when I was reading your story, it starts off with the Community First Medical Center in Chicago. And this was last year, July 26, 2021, when about 200 nurses assembled outside the medical center because they were pretty much fed up with the conditions there. And I'm thinking to myself, I didn't read much beyond that. I mean, I did read the article eventually, but I said to myself, I wonder who owns this medical center. And sure, in the next paragraph, you laid it out. It's an investment banking group, which has happened. You know this all too well. Newspaper industry. Same there. They pretty much hollowed out the employees and they sold off all the assets. Warrior Met, the coal company in Alabama, we've been watching that. They were purchased out of bankruptcy by an investment group, a hedge fund, and they've been on strike for over a year now. So let's talk about this because I think this is a big problem in America that needs to be addressed. I don't know how Congress can address this, stop them from buying up these hospitals and newspapers and big American companies. But talk to me about the nurses there and where we are today. Bryce, go ahead.
Yeah, I started with what happened at Community First, although I spoke to nurses across the country at very different kinds of facilities, and they all echoed the same thing, which is that they have been understaffed for years, long before the pandemic, but then the pandemic hit and it just all became just utter chaos and unsustainable breaking point working conditions. But I started with Community First because I think it really exemplifies what's been going on here. Like you said, in 2014, it was bought by an investment bank. They immediately come in and start slashing staff. They start slashing benefits. Of course, when you slash benefits, then you lose more staff because they try to go somewhere with better pay and better conditions. There was disinvestment that led to things like they didn't have IV fluid or even linens. The nurse, this didn't make it in, but the nurse told me they were using hospital gowns as bedding because they didn't have the linens they needed. So they unionized right before the pandemic hits in December 2019. Because they just felt like they couldn't take it anymore. And again, this was echoed by nurses I spoke to across the country. The main reason that they've been unionizing and going on strike and fighting in contract negotiations is to improve staffing, not so much their pay and benefits, although they would like to see improvements there. The number one issue that nurses have been dealing with for years, and particularly acutely in the pandemic, is low staffing levels. So that's what drives these nurses at Community First to unionize. Of course, then the pandemic hits, everything gets worse, and then they go into contract negotiations and they feel like they're just not being heard. So they went on strike, and they did it once, and then management didn't move, and then they threatened to do it for a longer amount of time over the Halloween weekend, which I guess is a very busy weekend at a hospital, and management finally made some concessions. The challenge is, you know, these nurses are taking on patient safety and care and their own safety and care through these actions, through strikes, through unionizing, through contracts. But these are like individual hospital-by-hospital efforts, and they are up against so much when what they really need is systemic changes. They need staffing ratios that are legislated. They need investment in the healthcare system, a revamped healthcare system that rewards hospitals for the kind of care that they give. They really can't do it on their own. So they're pushing and they're making some improvements, but it's such a big problem for nurses alone to solve.
And I noticed you mentioned the staffing changes. California was ahead of the game on that. And a lot of that is the California Nurses Association, which is part of National Nurses United. It started there. National Nurses started in California. And I know they were successful in the nurse-to-patient ratios, but I was reading in your article, even in California, some of the hospitals violated that ratio? Isn't that right?
Yeah. Nurses, I talk to nurses in California who say they regularly show up and there's more patients per nurse on that shift than there should be. And so they file these basically legal declarations saying, I object to the workload that I'm being given, and then it just keeps happening. It's particularly, like I said, they've been understaffed for years, nurses, hospitals across the country, but it's particularly just so acute in the pandemic. And that's a variety of things, right? I mean, nurses have been getting sick and even dying by the thousands. Some have decided to pursue work elsewhere. So the ones who are left are just so overburdened. I mean, people are taking on 10 to a dozen patients at once. They don't get any breaks. And they're working often 12-hour shifts. This is just mind-boggling, back-breaking work, but it is also such vital and important work. There's plenty of research that shows that the work that nurses do saves patients' lives and makes them healthier.
And one of the nurses you talked to in your article is Kathy Half, who's an RN worked at Community First Medical Center. Again, this is the Chicago story where the 200 nurses walked off the job. And she pointed out, because of lack of PPE when the pandemic was at its height, a number of nurses, three of her fellow nurses, died, including one told her daughter that she believed she was going to die because there wasn't enough PPE. I mean, she said that to her own kid, and then she ends up dying. And I guess she was one of the better nurses there, right?
Yeah, at least in half the estimation, she said she was an amazing nurse. Nurses have died by the thousands. There was not enough PPE in the beginning. Hospitals, I talked to a bunch of nurses in March and April 2020, and they were all saying, you know, the safety precautions aren't there. We are not being protected. We're reusing things. We're being told to put our masks in a brown paper bag. And lo and behold, they were getting sick and they were dying. And even the ones who didn't die have been often left with, you know, a lifelong mark. There was one nurse I spoke to in the early pandemic who had just gotten COVID. I spoke to her a year later and she was still suffering from long COVID. So they have, I mean, literally been on the front lines of this pandemic, been asked to sacrifice so much and just not been protected or supported when they have.
And talk about a slap in the face. OSHA, the Occupational Health and Safety Commission, eventually levied fines. But the fines, $13,000. I mean, come on. I mean, I know the fines are ridiculous. So why bother providing personal protective equipment if the fine is going to be that low? That's kind of way they run their operation. Let me ask you this, Bryce. Community First Medical Center, when the nurses walked out and eventually they had to go on strike, what happened at the hospital? I mean, what about the patients? Did they bring in outside nurses or what?
I think at this one it was management who tried to step up. From what I heard, it didn't go well. you know, it was a one-day strike, but it sounded like it was pretty chaotic inside that hospital. Who knows what the hospital would have resorted to had it gone on longer. You know, in the St. Vincent strike, which was in Massachusetts and went on for nearly a year last year, it ended last year, they brought in replacement nurses and people crossed the picket line to do that work. So who knows what would have happened in that standoff, but they were able to get management to come to the table after threatening to do it again. So it must not have gone very well the first time for management.
Right, right. We did a show on the Massachusetts nurses, and they were tied in with the electrical. A lot of unions supported them, including the electrical workers in that area, which were very, very vocal about what was going on in the state of Massachusetts. But I'm reading in your article, 76 strikes in healthcare between January of 2021 and April of this year alone. I mean, that's a lot. You would think that some of these medical institutions would be getting the message, but obviously they're not, are they?
Well, like you said, the on both OSHA fines and on these staffing ratios and the labor strife, you know, the financial incentives really aren't there for them. You know, healthcare costs in America are high and keep climbing. So hospitals really are facing difficult financial situations. And they just always see nurses as a cost and not a benefit, which is extremely backward because nurses, time and time again, have been proven to bring so much benefits that better staffing ratios actually pay for themselves because they keep patients from dying, they keep patients from coming back, they get them out faster because they help them heal faster. These are concrete benefits that are not just, you know, to people's emotional and physical well-being, but to hospitals' bottom line. But it's still too easy for hospitals to see them as just a labor cost, particularly when the way that hospitals are paid by insurance is by procedure, and doctors are doing all of these tests, and nurses are just coming and making sure you eat and checking in and how are you and taking your temperature, and none of that is billable, right? So the whole system is pretty messed up, but definitely hospitals have far too much of a corporate mindset of just cutting and cutting and cutting costs, and nurses are often one of the first things to get hit.
Bryce, let's talk about the union activity. And in your story, you point out that one study found that patients in unionized hospitals, I guess this was in California, the patients in hospitals that had a union were 5.5% less likely to die from heart attacks. And apparently another study found unionized hospitals outperform non-union ones in 12 of 13 patient outcomes. You know, to me, that's huge. That is huge, and I wish more people would pick up on that. And you take a look at these hospitals. For instance, this investment banking group that owns the medical center in Chicago, you know they fought the union drive over there like any corporation would. But that message is, I mean, that's important. We're talking about saving lives in a hospital that has a union in there that's representing the workers. Is that story starting to resonate in your opinion?
I think it certainly is with nurses themselves. There have been many union drives, you know, pre-pandemic, obviously, but also in the pandemic itself. I spoke to people who had never been involved before who are pushing to organize their coworkers or who had already done so, and they had voted overwhelmingly. Often these votes are just overwhelmingly in support of a union among nurses. And I think perhaps with the public, too, one of the perhaps silver linings of the pandemic is that it brought cameras and attention into hospital rooms in a way I think we haven't really seen before. The work that nurses do became so public and so just so visceral, I think, for the public that we've started to catch on to how important they are, but also how undervalued they are. So I think there's a lot of public support for what they do and also for improving the conditions in which they do it. And I would believe, along with that, support for having them unionize. I mean, like you said, it's pretty clear that there are benefits to having a unionized nursing work staff take care of you versus a non-union one. And you can imagine the ways in which that's happening. It's likely that they are fighting for lower nurse ratios, so there's more people to take care of you. They're probably fighting for better pay and benefits so you can attract higher quality nurses and keep them around and keep their expertise. It's not just about the nurses themselves, although of course it is. It really is about patient safety and care.
And the nurses, the unions, I know National Nurses United has been pushing, like I said earlier, the patient ratios. And I read, I guess in Illinois, they have a ratio of 4 patients to each nurse. And in some institutions, it's like 10 to 1. Let's be honest, this is what's happening in America today. But if you keep that ratio as low as that, You're saving money. Well, first of all, you're keeping people alive. In that study, they figured around 1,600 deaths, but they saved $117 million a year because of shorter patient stays. Now, to me, does the hospital want them to stay in there longer so they make more money? Is that what's going on here, Bryce?
I really just think they're not doing the math, to be totally honest. They just see it as an extra cost to have more nurses and don't look at the long-term benefits, which happens all over and over again in all sorts of budgeting discussions. But it's very clear that lowering your nurse-to-patient ratio, like you said, not only save lives, you would think that that would be a core priority, but even if it weren't, brings enormous financial benefits by shortening stays and improving people's health. So if hospitals could look at it that way, they would be incentivized, I think, to lower their ratios, but that just isn't the way that they're thinking about these things. And we could mandate that they think about it that way and they act this way by having, legally mandated staffing ratios, but the hospital associations put up very intense fights every time state legislatures go to consider that. It happened in New York. It happened in Massachusetts. Just really well-funded and vehement campaigns against safe staffing ratio legislation.
And one more question here before we break. The healthcare industry, you hear a lot about a nurse shortage, and then you hear stories, you should be a nurse because you're making a lot of money. And yes, some nurses, especially with advanced degrees, do make a lot of money. Let's be honest. Of course, the workload, like you mentioned, could be 12 hours a day. It's a lot of work. It's intense work. It's stressful work. But when it comes down to the shortage, nurses are quitting their jobs, and it's not because they don't like their job. They don't like the conditions in their job. Where are they going? Are they just going to hospitals that care a little more about the occupation? What are you finding?
I think the ones that offer good wages and benefits are attracting nurses and are attracting high-quality nurses as well, people with experience, people who are good at what they do, and definitely people flee the ones that race to the bottom. In the pandemic, there's, of course, been travel nursing, which if you are able to do is quite lucrative, where you, you know, basically go wherever you're needed and fill in, particularly with such a huge need in an ongoing pandemic. But exactly, it's not so much, you know, the industry does keep warning that there's a nursing shortage, but it's not so much that people don't want to be nurses. We keep setting records for how many people pass their nursing license exam. It's that they don't want to work under the conditions being offered. They can't keep doing it this way. There are plenty of people who desperately want to be a nurse. I asked most of these nurses, you know, why did you do this work? Why did you get into it? And they all say, I have a passion. This is a calling. I love what I do. I want to care for my patients. But they also then said to me, but I can't keep doing it like this. I can't keep doing it in these conditions. And some of them are considering leaving. And that's just such a loss to them and a loss to the rest of us.
And you're hearing that in a lot of professions today. I know we follow the teachers a lot. Same situation there. They want to teach. They love teaching, but they don't like what's going on with the administrations. And you can't blame them. You can't blame them. Once again, Bryce Covert. This is our segment we do with The Nation magazine each and every month. In the next segment, we're going to talk about forced arbitration. Later in the show, we'll be going to Philadelphia and checking in with Pat Gallagher on behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation. And we'll talk about what happened this week at the AFL-CIO Constitutional Convention.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Hello from the Communication Workers of America, District 4. We are a labor union representing a vast array of workers in different industries, including the Association of Flight Attendants, Telecommunications, CWA Passenger Services, Public Health Care, and Education Workers, the IUE, CWA Industrial Division, the National Association of Broadcast Employees, the CWA News Guild, not to mention our growing digital sector, and many others. If you're interested in organizing your work group or learning more about what it means to be CWA strong, visit our website at www.cwad4.org. That's cwad4.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at uaw.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and the platform known as Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, all you got to do is sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis. And give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings. We have a five-star guest on our show today. Let's make that a 10-star guest. Bryce Covert joining us. And she is one of the contributing writers of The Nation magazine. And she's been all over the place. She writes in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Washington Post, New York Magazine. She's done it all and appeared on ABC, CBS, MSNBC, NPR, and, of course, America's Workforce. There's another article I want to call attention to. And, you know, being the fact that this is a union show, we talk about union-related issues, and this is a biggie. It's forced arbitration, and apparently you did an article on this. It's time to end forced arbitration, and apparently Congress has kind of started the process, but they didn't go far enough. And what they did, and this was a couple of months back, where they approved ending forced arbitration for sexual assault and sexual harassment. But there's a lot more that needs to be done. Talk to me about this, Bryce, because when people, I guess, are in a position where there is forced arbitration, they usually end up on the losing end in various ways, especially when it comes to a monetary award. So talk to me about this.
Yes. Well, just to explain what forced arbitration is, when an employee or a consumer brings a complaint against a company, you know, normally you sort of expect that, you know, you file a charge, you file your lawsuit. If you don't settle, you go to court. More and more, that's not the case. Employers and companies are putting in their contracts these forced arbitration clauses, which say, if you file a complaint against me, we do not go to the courts. Instead, we go to this arbitration process, which is a private process, so the public's not invited. There's very little record. It's hard to know that it's even happening. So there's no real sunlight from public accountability. Usually the person arbitrating the case is some retired judge or a retired lawyer, typically picked by the company, so it tends to sort of lean in favor of the company. And workers and consumers just are outgunned in these situations. They are far less likely to win, and if they do, they're far less likely to get as much money as if they had gone to an actual court. And this practice really got a spotlight during the Me Too movement when many women and other people were speaking up against sexual harassment and sexual abuse that they'd experienced. It came to light that a lot of employment contracts stipulated that they could not take a sexual harassment complaint to court, and so it was buried in arbitration. Like I said, not public. So the public just didn't know this was even happening, and these women weren't able to speak out. Many of them decided to sort of break their silence anyway. But Congress acted, as you said, by passing a ban on forced arbitration when it comes to instances of sexual harassment or sexual assault, which is great. But that is just one of the many reasons that someone might want to bring a complaint against a company. And it makes no sense to have forced arbitration allowed for those other instances, but not for sexual assault. If you think it's bad there, it's bad everywhere.
So do you think Congress is going to move on this? I mean, they started the wheel here. Is the wheel going to keep going in the right direction on this or what?
You know, I don't want to sound too pessimistic. It's possible. It's always possible. It was really heartening, I think, to see Congress act on a bipartisan manner, first of all, to do anything, but particularly to take this issue on. You know, I do think that lawmakers were really moved by what happened in Me Too and what they saw, these stories and how they had gotten buried in this process and justice was not served. There are lawmakers who want to keep going and ban forced arbitration completely. And there was a bill in March that passed the House of Representatives. But with that bill that would ban it in all cases, you know, wage theft, racial discrimination, some kind of consumer complaint where you're being defrauded, say, just one Republican backed it, compared to 113 Republicans who voted for the sexual harassment-specific bill. So it seems like there's some kind of disconnect. Somehow we've decided that forced arbitration is bad when it comes to sexual harassment, and that's now a bipartisan issue. But these other instances where you're still suffering abuse and discrimination, it's okay to send those to these private spheres where the deck is stacked against you. Perhaps there will be some movement on that and some way to convince lawmakers that it's really two sides. It's not even two sides of the same coin. It is the same coin. I just haven't seen that movement yet.
And I want to credit the Economic Policy Institute, which you referenced in your article on this. It's time to end forced arbitration completely. We cite them on the show many, many times as epi.org. And they got some numbers. We're talking 60 million workers. 60 million are barred from taking their complaints to courts. And when you take a look at the outcomes, if you're in a state court, workers would win like 57% of the time. Arbitration, it drops to 21%. And there's an economic cost to this. Average damages awarded, say, in a state court, $328,000. Federal courts, $143,000. When it comes to arbitration, $23,548. And you point out in your article, Bryce, low-wage workers are the ones that are really getting screwed in this, aren't they?
Yeah, they are more likely to be subject to forced arbitration, which is sort of wild. These tend to show up in low-wage employer contracts, McDonald's, Walmart. Like, these are the people who are in most need of a monetary payout if they experience discrimination, and they're most likely to be denied it through this route. And that's just the ones that bring claims. The other thing that forced arbitration seems to do is to just dampen the drive to bring a claim at all, which makes some sense. It's already hard to speak out. It's already hard to speak up when something's happened to you and take the step of doing something about it, wanting to file a lawsuit or file a charge. When you then realize that buried deep in your employment contract is this clause that forces you into forced arbitration, which can be very expensive. Sometimes you have to pay for an arbitrator on your own as an employee or a consumer. That just seems to dissuade people. There was one study that found that basically none of the cases that we – it's like 2% of cases are actually getting filed in forced arbitration. You would expect 98% more of them to be filed, and they just sort of disappear.
Right. Yeah, when the employer says, take me to court, you're going to say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I got a lot of money to do that. I got to hire a lawyer. Well, that's not going to happen. And then as a result, you have to settle on what they give you, which is not going to be very much. Oh, I'll tell you, there's so much we can talk about. Bryce, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you back on the show here. And this is our segment again with the Nation magazine, Bryce Covert. Check out thenation.com. I'm sure you got other juicy stuff you're working on, and I'm sure we'll be talking down the road, okay?
Sounds great.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to go to the city of Philadelphia, where Pat Gallagher has been all week as a delegate to the AFL-CIO Constitutional Convention. He'll give us a rundown right after this.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to our live line right now. Welcome one of our regulars. Also a sponsor, we're talking about the North Coast Labor Federation, and the man in charge is Mr. Pat Gallagher, who just got back from Philadelphia for the 29th AFL-CIO Constitutional Convention, and the theme this year, building the movement to meet the moment. And we've got a moment going on right now with all the organizing that's happening from coast to coast, and Pat Gallagher was in the middle of it all. Hey, Pat, welcome back to the show. What did you think? You've been to a number of these conventions, at least a half dozen. How does this one rate?
Well, this was a very different kind of vibe here at this convention. It was more very proactive, very going forward and looking into the future and really talking about the future of labor movement, how important it is that we have a labor movement in our country because we're the social justice, social conscience of the country, and it was really a very good convention, very inclusive, was, you know, sent everybody back with a message that we got to work hard and protect the gains that we've got.
And the moment is organizing, and I know Liz Shuler talked about this Center for Transformational Organizing, or the CTO. I'm sure we'll get more details on that, but she apparently wants to seize what's going on in America right now. The timing is perfect. You got people that went through the pandemic. They were called heroes. Now they're called zeros. They got sick. Many of them died. They're organizing. We're looking at Starbucks. We're looking at Amazon. I mean, it's happening all over. So she just wants to continue that theme. She didn't give very many details on that. I guess this would be a something that's going to be in motion right now in the next couple of weeks? What are you hearing?
It's going to be developed, and it's going to be where the AFL-CIO is going to put resources into organizing. And they're going to look at a lot of different industries and a lot of different sectors and try to come up with the best, you know, boilerplate plan to attack these industries and to, you know, get people involved in organizing and get all the affiliates involved and provide assistance to the affiliates in their separate organizing drive. They talked about the Amazon drive in Alabama, where several other unions besides the retail clerks union participate and send in organizers. You know, steelworkers, we sent a couple organizers in there to help them with that. And so I think that's the kind of message we're trying to take, that organizing is, we're all in this together. We all need to organize. We all need to work together to find the best path to do so.
Well, one of the people that it's now Secretary Treasurer, that would be Fred Redmond, who you know all too well from the steelworkers. I mean, Fred's been with the steelworkers since 1973, and he was the Director of Human Affairs. He was also a vice president at the steelworkers. He is now the number two person. I heard him speak. Any takeaways from what Fred had to say?
Well, I've known Fred for almost 30 years, and he's a great guy with integrity, and he'll do a great job as Secretary Treasurer. In his acceptance speech, he made the comment, he said, "We will not rest until everyone who wants a union job can have one." And that got a rounding standing applause from everybody when he said that. And knowing Fred's character, he means it, and he's going to do everything he can to support organizing.
And what about Marty Walsh? What did Marty have to say?
Marty was great. He's the first card-carrying union member who's been the Secretary of Labor. He's from the Labor's Union in Boston. He was the mayor of Boston. You know, he made comments that we've got to extend the American dream with union organizing, and there's got to be an opportunity for all. And as Secretary of Labor, they're trying to support organizing in the public and the private sector. And the labor movement means something, and America needs a labor movement, is comments that he made, and we need to reverse the decline of union rights. And it was the first time, Flash, too, that the Department of Labor had a booth at the AFL-CIO convention.
Wow.
First time ever.
That's awesome. Well, we got a pro-union president, too, and I saw when Liz Shuler... This is on YouTube, and it's all over the place with President Biden's speech, and he went on for like a half an hour. It was really powerful. But what was the mood in the room when President Biden came in there? Can you describe that?
Everybody was just, you know, you got a round of applause for in there, and thanked all of us for his support, and said he wouldn't be president without the union movement and labor movement, and was very thankful for us, and went into a number of different stops. He's talked about his infrastructure bill, that it was not only to rebuild our country, but it's to rebuild the middle class, and went to the $3 billion for airports, $5 billion, you know, for electric vehicles, $20.5 billion for public transit so people can get to and from work. He urged the Senate to pass the PRO Act. He said we need to update our labor laws because they're heavily advantaged to employers, and he actually was correct about that. Then he made a real good joke that he was meeting with corporate leaders, and they were talking about how hard it was for them to keep employees. And President Biden asked him, "Well, why are these people leaving?" He said, "Well, because they're going for jobs that pay them more." And he just stopped and looked at him. But that's, you know, that's kind of really telling the message. So, and he talked a little bit about inflation, and you've got to remind everybody that this is global inflation. This is inflation in America, and that the $1.74 raise in the gas prices were all due to the war in Ukraine. As soon as that war started, those prices jumped up that much. It was price gouging by the oil companies. And, you know, part of the problem with food is there's 20 million tons of grain that's just stuck in Ukraine that the Russians got to blockade the Black Sea so they can't get it out of there. And all this is doubling over and leading to inflation. And he said that his working isn't done. He's got to address inflation. He's got to do things. He needs to have the tools to do so from Congress. He talked about lowering prescription drug costs, about access to high-speed internet for everybody, how utility bills are too high for everybody, and child care is too high.
Sure.
He needs to reduce all those things and trying to do what he wants. He also said he's enacted the largest release of oil in the history of the world. these loud drilling and get oil reserves be released and all that, trying to reduce the cost of gas and the cost of oil. So he also went and talked about, you know, wealthy and corporations paying their fair share. There was 55 corporations that made over $40 billion paid no federal taxes in the United States.
Wow.
And billionaires, they're paying no federal taxes. Those are things he wants to address. He said, too, that no American who makes less than $400,000 a year will ever see a tax increase while he's president.
There you go.
That was a really big commitment by him, and he was fantastic, and he hit a home run here at the convention.
That's good to hear. I'm glad he brought up about wages, because I just did a story yesterday on the show, Dollar General, and Dollar General workers are organizing, the CEO scratching his head saying, well, I don't know why we've got good working conditions here. And I found out that the average person at a Dollar General, and there's a lot of part-timers in there, makes just shy of $18,000 a year. Pat, how do you live on $18,000 a year? How could anyone do that?
Places like Dollar General, Walmart. I mean, they're getting corporate welfare. Over half of their employees are in assistance programs.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually subsidizing their low wages through our plans that we have, our social programs. That's wrong. Everyone should deserve to make a living wage, a family sustaining wage. Stacey Abrams, when she said this, we've got to get to move the working class to the middle class, and we need to sustain the middle classes. And we need to, you know, change the rules, not so that the wealthy and the rich gain everything, that it's an economy for all, and we can do it.
That's
and she
great.
Also made a great comment, too, that, you know, we can protect second graders and our Second Amendment rights with the right legislation. So, which I thought was very, very fitting for the times that we're in.
If we can protect second graders, we can protect the Second Amendment. All right.
And I think that's a great line, and it's absolutely correct. We can do that.
Right? There you go. It can't all be done. All right. What about politics? Did they get into that? We've got the midterm elections coming up here, and I know Stacey's running for governor of Georgia. What about that?
Well, we talked a little bit about electing pro worker governors across the country, and also we talked about that any legislator in Congress who has not signed on to the PRO Act should not get the support of the labor movement. It's passed through the House, you know, passed on a Democratic vote. It's sitting there in the Senate to be passed. It's actually the reform of the antiquated labor laws that we have that would help organize, would help protect workers. And it's something that needs to be done. And that's a valid point. They wanted a commitment from everyone that we wouldn't support or donate to any candidate who did not support the PRO Act.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. It all happened this week in the city of Philadelphia. They all gathered over the weekend on June 11th, and it wrapped up yesterday, the AFL-CIO 29th Constitutional Convention. But it sounds like it was a fired up crowd. And obviously with the midterms, and maybe you could speak to that, there's a lot of key races, and you know the state of Ohio. We got a key race to replace Rob Portman. So it sounds to me that everybody is ready to go, and who knows? You're hearing all kind of things in the media. Oh, they're going to beat the Democrats and all that. It sounds like it's a different kind of a atmosphere as a result of what happened in Philadelphia. What's your take on that?
No, I you know, don't believe what you read in the news. Don't believe that the fight's over until it's over. And we think that, you know, they're claiming victory way too early. And we believe that we can make some substantial gains in these midterm elections. And Tim Ryan is a great candidate. We're the labor movement solidly behind him in his Senate run. He's a common sense centrist Democrat that understands what it's about for working people. It's about jobs. It's about health care. It's about sustainable retirement. It's all the right things that he's pushing and he's for. It's about fair trade. He's doing a great job in his campaign trail, and we're going to do everything we can to make him the next senator from Ohio.
There you go. We'll leave it on that note. Pat Gallagher with the Steelworkers, District 1, and also with the North Coast Labor Federation. You take care, my brother, and we'll talk next month, okay?
Okay. Thanks, Flash.
All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the American Legion and the Alliance for Retired Americans. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.